Hey there, and welcome to episode 4 of Crosshairs Radio. Today on the program, we have Colt McElwain. You probably know Colt from Cycling Dirt and also from Behind the Barriers TV. Great dude. Started out as a cyclocrosser and mountain biker, was passionate about it, got into broadcasting, into the media side of things, really revolutionized a lot of what we see today as far as grassroots broadcasting of cyclocross rates. And then by the time he got to Behind the Barriers TV, took it to a whole nother level. Have a great conversation with Colt about U.S. cyclocross, going back into history and looking at how he started cycling dirt, and then moving on to some predictions. We recorded this before Gloucester, so we have some predictions about what may have happened, and you can see if we got it right or got it wrong. And then we also talk about individual riders. We play a little game at the end. It's a really cool, long discussion, a little over an hour, so I'm not going to talk much more now, so we can get right into that. Please do me a favor, subscribe to the podcast, like it, review it on iTunes. Also follow me on Instagram and on Twitter at CXHairs, C-X-H-A-I-R-S. And if you have anything you want to add to the show or make any comments or yell at me for something, do that at feedback@cxhairs.com. All right, let's talk to Colt. We are talking with Colt McElwain. Did I pronounce that right?
You did.
Awesome. So, Colt, let's you are best known for a company that you started, Cycling Dirt. At least that's where I guess a lot of the people listening to this got to know you, got to know your hands and your gestures, and also who's number one and all these great things that you were doing. All this coverage for every cyclocross race out there, all these mountain bike races. But before we get to that, give me a little bit of your background. You know, where are you from? Where did you grow up? When did you get into riding bikes?
Yeah, sure. So 2015 is a good year to look at, because this is officially my 20-year anniversary of racing bikes. So I started as a little kid in the Cub Juniors and the kids races, and my dad grew up racing mountain bikes. So started racing with him out of New England, and for most of my life, that's what I was. I was a bike racer, first and foremost. So as a junior, I primarily competed in mountain biking, eventually rode and crossed, did the whole, you know, Norbis scene and national tour, and raced World Cups on the road and all that kind of stuff. So for a long time, especially people in New England or in the mountain bike community, that, I mean, they knew me as a racer. I raced for Independent Fabrication, I raced for Kona. So around 2008, it was a couple years into my U23 racing career, if you want to call it that. I wasn't making any money. I was mid-pack elite rider and cross. Having a blast doing it, loving the sport, but like everyone kind of at that age these days, just looking for sustainability. And I just wasn't finding it in the form of racing bikes. So at the time, I was, I think, a sophomore at the time at Harvard. I was doing my undergrad, and I was living in this condo up 20 minutes north of the city. I didn't have a lot of friends. I was just training and racing. I lived in this building with no internet and no TV, no TV and nothing. I had internet access, and I just started watching a lot of videos online. YouTube was kind of new at the time, and I found this one website that covered track and field. And they had all these races and interviews with athletes and coaches, and I connected with it. Even though it was a different sport, listening to these athletes talk about their passion for competing and their activities, it, so much of it translated to me. And I just remember thinking, like, man, I wish I had this as a resource for bike racing and for cycling. And so I was a couple weeks later, I got pretty sick, and I was hanging out at some bike races, and I wasn't racing. I was actually at the Supercross race down on Long Island. And I thought, well, I was doing what I was seeing in these videos. I was hanging out. I was talking to all my buddies after the race. If I had a camera in my hand, I could upload these. I mean, this would be valuable stuff. People want to hear these conversations. So the next week, I went out, just went down to Best Buy, dropped all the money I had on a video camera, showed up the next morning at NBX in Rhode Island, the UCI race, and just spent all day just playing with the camera, filming Masters races, doing interviews with a bunch of elite riders, and it took a few months before that stuff finally got posted, and eventually I connected with my eventual business partner out of Texas in a company called Flowcast, and very quickly the whole thing with Cycling Dirt sort of took off. And I had no media, but, I mean, I was studying environmental sciences and I had a bike racing background, but I knew nothing about cameras and editing and Final Cut and all this stuff. And I jumped in with both feet, and the whole thing just, I mean, it, I hesitate to say it caught on like wildfire. It caught on slowly, but there was clearly a need for it, and I found myself kind of suddenly as the guy providing that. And kind of the rest is history in terms of the media stuff. It just, when you're, and you know this, I mean, when you're talking to athletes and you're interviewing so many different people, it's just so many opportunities present themselves because of that and the relationships you build there. So I've been everywhere and done everything ever since, but it all started back at MBX, I think it was 2008.
Yeah, and that was such a great time to do it, especially for cyclocross, because you said, one, you're filling this niche, but also it's at that time that the sport is really starting. We really saw that first big explosion. I mean, it was popular, but it was pretty small, you know, except for New England and, you know, pockets of California and Pacific Northwest. But, you know, where I raced in the Mid-Atlantic 2008, we were just starting to grow, and it was just starting to explode, and you had all these people moving over from road to cross. So having you out there to fill that space at that time, it was perfect.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, like I was kind of sheltered from that to some extent growing up in New England. I mean, thanks to, you know, the Paul Curleys and the Tim Johnsons and the Adam Meyersons and what they had built for us there with the Verge New England series. I mean, in 2001, I was coached by Mark McCormick, who multiple time, you know, cross national champion, him and Frankie. And so, I mean, I grew up in this world where Gloucester was down the street. That was the first cross race I ever did. And to me, I didn't know that the rest of the country didn't, you know, also do this every weekend. And so if I hadn't grown up in New England, for sure, I would never have been able to start what I did. But you're right. I mean, starting to jump around to the USGPs and stuff at that time, it was the first of many tipping points with cyclocross. But that couple of years there was a big one.
Yeah.
With guys starting to really focus on it, and it became a spotlight event and not just an off-season activity.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me a little bit about, you know, from that, it built into what I'm assuming became your full-time job with Cycling Dirt, and just going into that business, moving to Austin, that whole opportunity. What was your vision? What did you go in there hoping to do with that venture?
Man, so at first it was another project. It was just, I mean, I can't ever sit still for more than 5 minutes, and this was just another example of that. And if you had asked me at the beginning, I would have said, oh, I'll probably do this for a couple of weeks or for the off season, and then I'll start racing again. And I had every intention of, you know, figuring out a way to continue my career as a bike racer. As I got started and I really saw the response and what it meant, not even so much to the audience, to just the average fan, but what it meant to the athletes that were competing. I mean, these were my friends that I'd grown up racing with. To see what it was doing for them, to help give them a platform to showcase themselves on, it felt like an obligation to keep doing it. You know, if I wasn't going to do it, who was?
Right.
And so after a while, I kind of had this thing in my head where I said, you know what, if I can help the sport enough to the point where I could go back to racing and get paid to finish 15th, then I'll drop the whole thing and I'll go back to bike racing. And I can't say that I ever got to that point. It ultimately grew into way bigger of a business than I ever foresaw. But originally that was my goal. It was, you know, if I can give a platform here and create something where the, you know, the 15th place guy has a way to show off his sponsors and kind of create a name for himself. And to a lot of extent, I think we did that.
Yeah.
And, you know, giving a voice to all these guys, you know, a guy like Brian Motter or a guy like, you know, Barry Wicks, even to some extent, where like he was relevant and he was racing his bike and he was winning at some point, but Barry Wicks finishing 18th isn't very valuable, but Barry Wicks finishing 18th and giving you a post-race interview that gets viewed 6,000 times, that's very valuable to a sponsor and to a guy like Barry. And so it gave rise to a lot of these personalities in the sport. Jeremy Powers being a great example of that. In recent years now, he's gone on to be this dominant force that can't be beat. But in 2008, 2009, I mean, Jeremy was just another one of those guys knocking at the door, you know, a top five podium guy. But his personality and what came across in his interviews is ultimately what really launched him into the spotlight.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So from that experience, from that early experience, you know, even if it didn't end the way that you wanted it to end or envision, what was your greatest takeaway? I mean, you got to do some really cool stuff. Is there something that stands out from that time that you're like, man, if it wasn't for this, I would have never been able to do X?
Well, gee, man, if it weren't for my wife, I never would have been able to do it. I mean, she, like, I mean, to travel, like, you know, bike racers think they, you know, bike racers do, they travel a lot, but they still take weekends off or they recover, they rest. I mean, I was just for basically 4 years, just hustling and grinding every single weekend, every single race I could get to because I needed to. I went to a race, it created videos, it created content, which led to views, which led to revenue. And so to make it sustainable, I was on the road. So if it weren't for her putting up with it, first and foremost, I never would have done it. Beyond that, I mean, I can't even count how many just opportunities came. I mean, I went to London, I covered the Olympics and mountain biking, cyclocross World Cups and World Championships. And to a lot of extent, like looking back on what I said about racing, where, you know, I always kind of thought I would come back and race, I found that through this media channel, I was able to kind of fulfill a lot of these life goals that I'd always had. Like as an athlete, you want to race World Cups, go to Olympics and things like that. I didn't get to race them. I probably never would, even if I went and trained my ass off. But I got to experience those events. I got to be in that world and have these relationships with athletes and teams and event promoters and things like that. So just becoming a part of that community and feeling like I got to know more people than anybody in that industry. I mean, I felt like through those years, nobody was at more bike races than me. Nobody had more conversations with athletes or event promoters or marketing guys. I mean, every day I talked to everybody. And when you're interviewing people and you get to sit down with them, you get so much more than that 10-second, hey, how was your race? Okay, cool, see you next weekend. You really get to know everybody. So I felt like I walked away from it with 1,000 friends.
Yeah, that's awesome. So moving from that, where you're sort of doing these in-person post-race videos and then sort of bringing that into the race broadcasting realm, how did that happen? When you guys were doing, especially with Behind the Barriers TV and going out and doing better production at cyclocross races than we've seen ever before, what's that transition like? And how did that even happen?
Sure. I mean, with Cycling Dirt, the whole model was kind of guerrilla coverage. It was, you know, here I am with my, you know, $500 handy cam and I can go do 100 interviews and I can upload them all that night. The quality, however, was not the priority. It was more quantity and just giving something that didn't exist before. So when I ultimately left Cycling Dirt, and we could do a whole other story on how that happened and right. why I left, but you know, as it happened, that kind of ended, and I found myself on the phone with, you know, I got a lot of calls right after I left, like, hey, come do this, or why don't you start this? And I didn't want anything to do with media after that. I had enough of it. I was looking for something else. And Jeremy Powers called me and probably right after Nationals, I guess, probably late January, early February, and wanted to talk about, you know, hey, you're gone. There's nothing out there. What are we going to do? I mean, he relied on it as much as the events relied on it, as much as I relied on it to give, you know, give spotlight and give credibility to what everybody was doing. And we came up with the concept of Behind the Barriers TV, in that, you know, maybe we don't do 1,000 interviews or go to every race around the world, but we really wanted to legitimize the sport at a professional level. And that meant hiring real camera operators and not, you know, having me run around with my flip cam, having a real professional editor put their touch on. I mean, the smallest things, when you watch Behind the Barriers TV, maybe you didn't recognize this stuff, but it's things like having a graphics card come up with results on it and having the little theme music and having the light flare as it flashes.
Between oh, absolutely.
Like those tiny things. I mean, that's what makes the difference between, you know, an uncut YouTube video and something that you're going to watch on Red Bull TV or OLN or Versus or whatever it's called these days. So that was our approach. We wanted to professionalize the media coverage to the same level that the athletes were at and the events were at.
Yeah. Backing up again, because looking for highlights, I just not even sure if you remember this. Well, one of the highlights that you had wasn't even a race, or I had of what you did wasn't even a race. Interview. It was like the middle of the night and Adam Meyerson on Twitter going on about how he had just found out that the UCI wasn't going to let him have a series anymore because it was the mix. Right. It was the mixed series, you know, between the UCI and non-UCI races, and they had too many races or whatever it was. And you were basically cool, grabbing the microphone, grabbing the tape recorder, driving over to Adam's house and interviewing him that night and getting it up like the next morning and having the whole story out. And, you know, that to me just exemplified this guerrilla approach that, you know, really got me excited and got me wanting to do what I'm doing now.
Totally. I mean, that's, and like I said before, if I weren't in New England, I don't think that this would have been possible. There was so much available to me there. I mean, you look at, you have Meyerson, but you also have, Powers is right down the street. Tim Johnson is right down the street. Jamie Driscoll's right down the street. Al Anderson at the time was just down the street. You know, we had just this great resources of the best events and some of the best athletes that, I didn't have the budget to get on a plane and go fly out and talk to these guys. But yeah, just being down the road and also being, like I said, I don't think, and this goes for a lot of people who do things that they're passionate about, but it's like, you couldn't have paid someone to do the work I was doing. You know, the hours are ridiculous. It's just, the work is too hard. To me, it wasn't hard because I loved what I was doing, but just loving the sport and having these relationships with people. Yeah, something like that happens and I can give a voice to a friend of mine with Adam Meyerson. Sure, get on the phone, Adam. I'll be there in 15 minutes. If you live down the road, let's talk about this. Let's give it a spotlight. And Adam's a perfect example of where, Adam could have been 10 years ago, he could have written a blog about it, or Velo News could have done a story about it that came out a couple weeks later. But to put a face to it and to be able to hear the passion in Adam's voice when he talks, I mean, that stuff is invaluable to create that groundswell of, fans and people like yourself watch that, and it makes them understand the situation in an educated way, and they can actually do something about it. So, yeah, and I'm glad you remember that. I hadn't even thought of that in a while, but that was another one of those examples of just, like, such a cool opportunity. Like, who am I, right? I got to be the guy that sat across from him and had all these conversations and sitting across from all these other athletes and stuff. It was cool. I feel like I was always getting to be the fly on the wall for these really interesting topics.
Yeah, and you hit on something else that I really appreciate hearing, and that I get a lot of questions about it as well. It's like, well, how do you get to do this? How do you get to talk to so-and-so, or how do you get to do this or that, or how do you start? I want to start doing this. And my response to most people is, you just go do it. It's like, do it. Yep. You'll screw it up. You won't always get it right, but you're not gonna do anything by just trying to research it or look what the right answers are or ask people. Just go out and do stuff. That's the most important thing.
So especially with interviewing, I mean, I always just looked at it as, there's a time and a place to do your research and to be prepared. But if we're talking about a post-race interview or just simple stuff, it's just a conversation. I'm not going to do research before I go have a conversation with somebody about the race. So I viewed it the same way. Like, hey, there's a camera here. Ignore that. Let's chat for 5 minutes about how your day went. I mean, I never thought about, oh, the camera's on. I got to ask them these questions so that the audience will think this. I mean, it was just, what was I interested in? What did I want to hear about? Where did the conversation go? And I think people appreciated that. We weren't trying to talk down to anybody. We weren't trying to simplify it or dumb it down for the audience. It was, I understood the sport at a high level. The athletes understood the sport at a high level. We would have these, very in-depth conversations about things. And as the general fan who would never get to be a part of that, inside the team trailer, inside the team tent, it made them feel more exclusive to, like, get access to these guys kind of talking candidly and openly about their racing and their training and their opinion. So, yeah, totally. Just go for it.
Yeah, so when I saw you last Wednesday at Cross Vegas and we got to talk briefly, you said to me, it's sort of weird, it's the first time you've been at Cross Vegas where you're just sort of hanging out. So
yeah.
I know you're not just hanging out. You're still involved in the sport. I know you were out there announcing for Reno, but other than that, so what are you doing now? What's cold up to these days?
Sure. So underneath all the racing and the media stuff, I mean, the thing that I've actually been most enthusiastic about and most passionate about forever has been coaching. So when I was 18, I started a 501c3 nonprofit junior development team out of New England, and I was coaching 9 kids. And I've been coaching ever since. I've had a mix of clients, mostly cyclocross, mountain biking, and some other stuff as well. So all through Cycling Dirt, I was coaching. When I left, that was the time when I said, all right, well, this is where I'm going to focus on my coaching business. And so kind of pushed that a little more and took on a lot more clients and had been doing that for the last 2 or 3 years and doing some freelance media stuff along the way and doing Behind the Barriers in the fall. Not to sound stupid or anything, but I turned down a lot of jobs along the way. Obviously, people would, anytime there was a media project, someone would think, well, let's maybe get Colt to help out. And I didn't want to get back into that world again. And then Scott Tedra, who a lot of people might know that name if they're familiar with mountain biking, Scott Tedra came to me and we had a long talk about the state of mountain biking and sort of what I could do to help him in the Showair business that kind of owns the sport of mountain biking in North America. I mean, they own the biggest pro team. They own the Pro XCT in the U.S. Cup Series and Kenda Cup East, Kenda Cup West. And so Scott kind of gave me an opportunity that I couldn't refuse to come in and really affect a lot of change in mountain biking. And so as we speak, I'm sitting out here in California. I just finished unpacking my storage shipping containers and ready to hit the ground running with something new, something totally different. But ultimately, I never would have had this opportunity if it weren't going back to cycling gear and those things before. It's all the same. It's all building community. I mean, when you're coaching, you're building a community with your athletes. When you're racing, you're trying to build a community of people that follow you. When you have a media business, you're trying to build that community of people who come to your site daily and experience that content. And so now I'm in a new position, a new task, but it's the same thing. It's building community around events, building community on a greater scale in the sport of mountain biking, trying to get it back to something that we could call a heyday.
That's great. Now I'm assuming it's still something that you're passionate about, because that seems to be what, you know, is commendable about how you choose these opportunities. It's you know, doing the media, you were sort of over that, so you find something, you know, still cycling related, still find something that you're passionate about, and seems like it's something that you'll be able to spend all that same time, and it doesn't seem like work.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine I would be a pretty horrible employee like in doing any real type of job ever. But when it comes to cycling world and bike racing, I mean, none of this stuff feels like work to me. So whether it's, you know, uploading a video all night or you know, on the phone all day, selling advertising, whatever it might be, you know, it's like talking to you right now. I mean, having these conversations does not feel like work. It just feels like we're hanging out with our buddies talking about bikes.
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to Cross Vegas, since you were there and since you sort of seeing it through fresh eyes, what was your takeaway? What's your takeaway about having this World Cup in North America and also the level of racing and what you saw on that night?
Oh man, that it was not having to, you know, technically work on that night, not being in, you know, in a RV, just talking to the microphone, really getting to breathe it in and experience that whole night was kind of surreal. I mean, first and foremost, just it made me super proud of the work that so many people have put in to get that event there. I mean, I can't tell you, I mean, all the way back to when I was racing in, you know, 2001 and 2002, I remember having conversations with people about, hey, do you hear Providence might be getting a World Cup next year? And, you know, it's been in the works for so long. And for someone to finally, you know, by the time it actually happened, we didn't care what venue it was or who was doing it. We knew that, you know, Richard Freese had as much to do with making that race happen as Brooke Watts did, as Adam Meyerson did, as you know, so many different people that came before them. So I think just for the cyclocross community as a whole, I think it was something really fun to celebrate. The racing, I mean, it's out of control. It's just on a different level. I mean, even just in the last 3 or 4 years, the level at the world stage has gone up like 5 or 10%. And it's cool that we have guys like Powers now and some other women and men that are able to get close and compete there. But I mean, the speeds at the front of the race, I mean, not having been in the race, but from my perspective, those speeds just, they keep getting exponentially faster year after year.
Yeah. I mean, we like covered the start, and then it was this, you know, photographer scrum, just to sort of catch as much as the, first lap as we could. And I just ran up the starting stretch and then got into the finish line corral. And when they came off that prologue, I mean, it was, I had to take a step back because they were just flying around that first turn, like faster than I've ever seen any race at that place. It was truly amazing.
Oh, awesome. And to not be a part of the media and to watch you guys run around was also actually pretty cool and pretty rewarding. I mean, to think back to covering Cross Vegas in, you know, 2008 or 2009, you know, there's three of us on the finish line. My dad, which is the photographer for Cycling News, you know, myself with a video camera, and maybe, you know, like Neil Rogers or someone for Velo News. You know, there was a couple people. So to see it now with the international media and to see 50 different people, you know, every single racer after the race, someone had a camera in their face and they were interviewing them. And so that to me is super cool to see, to just realize that, you know, at one time where you didn't have access to any of this, your access to cyclocross content now, if you're willing to search it out, there's just so much out there to devour. And that's, you know, I look back to like kids like myself when I was 15, 16, it was that content that ultimately kept me in the sport for 15 years. And so it makes me so excited to think of, like, the juniors nowadays, like, sitting at home on their iPhones and just watching these interviews with Sven and, you know, watching Svenness and all this kind of stuff. And it's just super cool. Super cool.
Yeah, that's going to be surreal, like, in 10 years when these guys are like, oh, yeah, my dad used to show me Svenness. Because I get that now. And then, you know, you're going to... When these kids get older, it's it just blows my mind. So today, Iowa City Press Citizen published a story, you know, saying that the Jingle Cross promoters were meeting with UCI officials in Vegas and had seemed to have given a proven formula for having a successful World Cup race. What are your thoughts on that? Second U.S. World Cup.
I mean, absolutely, right? There's no one doesn't want another World Cup. I'm sure everyone is going to argue about who should get it and which venue it should go to. You can't find a better venue than Jingle Cross. There's other venues that are just as good. Don't get me wrong. I love my Gloucesters and my Providences. Since he has some great courses, Jingle Cross has by far a World Cup caliber course. For anyone who's raced there and seen the videos off Mount Crumpet, and you know, it's very similar to Cross Vegas in the sense it almost has like a carnival vibe to it with so many different obstacles, the Yule logs and the Grinch's Lair and all this stuff. So yeah, man, I would just love that. I love Jingle Cross. If they can make it work with the schedule, hell, I mean, I think even if they move it to September, I think they've still got to keep the Christmas theme. I think why not? The Euros are you think are crazy over here?
Right.
All have like. Might as well have the Grinch's music playing in the barn and Christmas lights and all that. But yeah, yeah. I mean, the more the better. I mean, it's just, you know, I think after Louisville 2013, I think there was a bit of like a post-world depression in the community. I think a lot of athletes and fans and especially industry spending money, I think a lot of people overextended themselves coming into worlds, and it kind of left a little bit of like a down period immediately following that. I mean, you could kind of feel it in 2013 and even a bit last year, especially if you're in the world of trying to sell advertising, you know that a lot of these guys, they were kind of scaling back. But with Cross Vegas, with guys like Powers now competing on a world level, it feels like that right time again. The energy feels as high as it's ever been. So yeah, if we can capitalize on it now, by all means, let's bring the whole freaking World Cup over here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but that does beg another question, and it's something that I think Ryan Trebone was hitting on in social media today, is that may not be the answer. It's great, but that's not the answer for U.S. cyclocross, in that, you know, 1 to 3 weekends of excitement every year isn't going to, in the long run, help. And I'm sure what he's concerned about mostly is domestic pros, but then other racers as well, you know, and something else needs to happen. Possibly, I think what he was getting at is we need to find a way to have a true pro domestic series again.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when Bruce and Bruce Fina and Joan Hanscom and the USGP went away, that was for sure a major loss. And we've been trying to replace that in one way or another now ever since, and we definitely haven't done that yet. So that's one of many conversations we can have on, you know, how to grow the sport and how to save the sport. I don't think that those conversations need to all be rolled into one. I don't think bringing a World Cup eliminates what we could also do in having a series, or what we could also do for development of the sport and things like that. I mean, for the elite athletes to compete. I mean, you saw Jeremy Powers, a World Cup, comes to the U.S. He has the best ever World Cup finish. The more level racing that we have like that over here in the U.S., the better it's going to be for those top 5 or 10 professional athletes that are trying to crack that next level. And I do think to some extent with a race like Worlds or World Cup being here, I think it is an example of, you know, the rising tide does float all boats to some extent. I mean, how many more people become excited about the sport? How many other races kind of pop up around that? Now if there's a World Cup, now there's more UCI racing around because people need the points to qualify. And I don't think it's a bad thing by any means. I think you have to be careful with how much attention you put on it and maybe how much you invest in it. You know, like I said, with Worlds, I'd hate to see, you know, everybody jump on board and spend all their money and all their resources and all their attention on the 2 World Cups and forget about the rest of the year. But there's enough awesome races out there that you know, someone's just got to come in, and it doesn't take major fixing. We have some minor tweaks that can go a long way in how we work our schedule and how we build a pro series.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think about the argument that one of the downfalls of being a pro in the U.S. is that the courses aren't hard enough? And this comes to the whole pro-only section, sure. You know, argument that in Belgium, you know, in places like that, they're on these super hard courses and there aren't any amateurs out there. So no one's going to get hurt. No one's going to have a problem with these technical areas. U.S., you know, we sort of have to have a course that everybody can race. But at the same time, we don't have spectators paying to support an eight race series that's only pros. So where's the middle ground?
Right. And so first of all, I think there are a lot of people out there that kind of blindfully just say, well, let's just make the courses harder. Why not? You know, there's a lot of B men and masters guys that, yeah, that would be very capable of riding a harder course. But, you know, having my wife just raced her second ever cross race last weekend. And she was terrified to even ride the flyover. And
yeah.
So I appreciate the courses the way they are for the reason that they are the way they are. And they need to be that way. So that is first and foremost. At the UCI level for the elites, I am a big fan of pro-only sections. I understand it's a lot more work for the promoter, but not only is it great development for our elite athletes, but it makes those races so much more fun to spectate, and it just gives you that talking point. Like every race that's ever done a pro-only section, it's gotten massive attention, tons of social media buzz, everyone's posting videos on Instagram of it. So I think for the promoter, that work that goes in, you certainly get it back in terms of the exposure you're getting from it. But ultimately, to some extent, the courses here, they just never will be European courses. I mean, it just is never going to be that way. As long as we have amateurs racing on the same courses as elites, they have to be different. Now, there might be a time for some elite-only UCI events. I don't see that in the foreseeable future. I don't see a model where we can have a sustainable event without registration fees helping fund it, but if we could get there someday, sure, I'd be all for it. But pro-only sections, I think that's a big part of it. And then, fortunately or unfortunately, a big part of that development for our elite athletes today is you just got to go to Europe. You got to raise the money or find a way to do it, go over for Christmas, do what you got to do. But we will always be an underdog, as this is always going to be the Euros sport, first and foremost.
Yeah. You know, I talked to Gavin Haley at Cross Vegas, and he's, you know, one of the guys that actually goes over there and will live for more than just Christmas. He'll live for, you know, a month at a time, has taken the time to learn Dutch, you know, speak Flemish, that kind of stuff, and has a host housing. He said, you know, the advantage is he doesn't have to think about anything. Everything's just, he's living there. So nothing is, you know, out of the ordinary. He's just doing what he needs to do, goes, trains, races, and that he's friends with the people he's racing against, you know, the other international riders. So he's not looked at this, you know, American that no one wants to get near, or they put him into the tape because they don't know what he's going to do. He's just one of the guys. And I think that's maybe the commitment that some of these folks need to take to get to that next level.
Totally. I mean, it's one thing to go over there and to do a race or two and get your teeth smashed in, and just it opens your eyes to what that level is. It's a totally different thing to live there, to race on those courses so many times that it actually makes you a better, you know, bike handler and a better tactical bike racer. But you pick up so many other things along the line as well, of just how to live as a pro athlete. I mean, you look at what some of these guys, you know, like Katie obviously has lived over there, what Jonathan Page has been able to do basing himself out of Europe. But again, even a guy like Powers, who has dominated here for the last 3 or 4 years, you have to go all the way back. I think it was maybe 2006 or 2005 where, you know, when Powers was racing for Jelly Belly, he went over as a U23 and lived in Europe. I mean, he left his girlfriend, he left his family. He went over there to get his teeth smashed in. But without those years living in Europe, there's no way he'd be where he is today.
Right.
I mean, he developed, he grew so much from that. There's no easy way to get there, but a guy like Gavin he's putting in the time, he's putting in the hustle, and good for him.
Yeah. Joe Dombrowski always tells one of my favorite stories about going over there for Christmas and the difference between US and European cross. He's like, you know, I can remember one stretch where I got kicked, my jersey pulled, and elbowed in the face, all within like a minute, yeah. And that was still in the starting grid.
I love Joe. I hope everyone remembers that Joe was a cross racer before he was a big deal on that.
Oh, he raced my series. I've announced more Joe Dombrowski races, you know. I mean, the time he was a minute late for his race and still ended up winning by 30 seconds, you know, it was just insane stuff, that guy.
Well, and you'll appreciate this out of the Mid-Atlantic, but the first mountain bike race I ever covered for Cycling Dirt was the Rockburn Reloaded. I just was looking on the schedule, like, what's the first mountain bike race?
Oh, that's awesome. Nice.
I want to try this out. That was the first race I ever covered, and he was there racing in the junior race. I had no idea who he was.
Right.
And he was one of the first people I ever interviewed, and he was just kind of this, like, kind of known kid out of the Mid-Atlantic. He had just gone to Eurocross camp for the first time, but, just, again, another example of how, like, I never would have gone up and talked to that random junior at the race.
Right.
But because of that opportunity, because of that interview and what that grew into, and now to, you know, to be able to call him a friend, and if I see him in a race, I'll go up and chat with him, and not super cool.
Yeah. So after Cross Vegas, you had the opportunity to announce the race and go hang out at Reno Cyclocross,
yeah,
which is going to be the site of the 2018 Nationals course. From everything I saw and heard about the race, it was like a super professional, you know, job just from the jump. You know, what's your impressions of what went down there?
Totally. So Teal Stetson Lee, who a lot of people will know by name, she races for Scott Bikes. She rode for Lunatics for a few years. Super talented cross racer out of Durango, Colorado. So she lives in Reno now. She got together with a couple of partners. And Teal is, I'm trying to think of like a less corny word than visionary, but like she's a visionary. And so she had a vision for what a cyclocross event could be, different than what we've always done. And so she's worked with these partners for the last year, and Teal and I have had a bunch of conversations about it, but she wanted to create this festival. And so she had this huge, in her first year, this huge successful cyclocross race and music festival that, to me, redefined what a bike race like this could be about. I mean, I totally didn't expect it to be this big of a success, and I was blown away. I mean, they had a huge stage. They had live music, like good live bands playing 45-minute sets from the start of the day to the finish of the day. And they had super high-level cross racing on an awesome design course. So from that perspective, it was cool. There was a lot of stuff that went into that race that other people hadn't done before. Thinking about Nationals for 2018, I'm super excited. People from the West Coast are going to love it. Like NorCal people, SoCal people, all the guys who race cross in Utah and Colorado. The course is really going to make them smile. Teal did a lot of cool stuff. She comes from kind of a mountain biker background. She races a lot of enduro. So she put a lot of technical elements into that course that really pushed the limits of your average cross rider. I don't know what else to say about it other than I'm excited to get out there. I mean, if they can keep that same energy that she's created in this festival and roll that into what Nationals will be in 2018, a lot of people are going to look at that as one of the better Nationals, I think, that we've had.
Well, one of the things that, has been talked about, and I haven't even seen any video of it, so I don't know, is the introduction of an A and a B line and some skinnies in there, and it's definitely raised some eyebrows. So give me the lowdown on that section and your thoughts on if it belongs in cyclocross. If you have a section where only one person can go over an element at a time, what does that do? Is that good? Is that bad? Mm-hmm. Talk to me about it.
Totally. Yeah. So, I mean, coming from a mountain bike background, if you watch mountain bike World Cups or you've ever been out to one at Wyndham or something, you know that A lines and B lines are just a part of the sport now. And they're awesome. I mean, if you're a spectator, that's where you're going to go. You want to see who's going to take the A line jump or who's going to take that crazy descent or whatever it is. They want to see that element of risk reward in a bike race. So for the fans, it's awesome. I think most racers are a big fan of it. It's never been implemented in cross before. So what Teal had, and I think what a lot of people saw pictures of, this was called I hope I could remember the official name. I think it was the LP Insurance Hazing Pit. So it was a standard set of barriers with a bunch of hay thrown around in the middle, like, I don't know, like unbaled hay, so that it would make it really difficult to bunny hop the barriers. And then on either side of the barriers, there was, I guess it was a 2x6 plank that ramped up, went across the barriers, and then had a little drop at the end. And so it was awesome to watch the dudes on the first lap and the women on the first lap come barreling around this corner, and you got Ben Bearden dismounting and running through the middle. You got Cody Kaiser coming up the left and riding over one plank. You got Troy Wells on the right riding the other plank. You got other guys trying to bunny hop through the hay. You know, did it impact the race in any substantial way from a finisher's standpoint? No, it was a quarter of a second, maybe at most, here or there, and the rest of the race was just the way the tactics played out. I don't think it made any difference in that sense. But there were so many spectators there, and so many, I mean, the fact that that's what you've heard about, it shows, like, if you're a race promoter and you have the opportunity to put those kind of elements into your race, why not do it? The racers had fun with it. The media had fun with it. Twitter has fun talking about it. I'm all for it.
Yeah, and I think the only negative comments I heard were from people who weren't there. I haven't heard any, and maybe you have. I didn't hear anything bad from anybody who actually raced it. Georgia Gold, I talked to her last week. She loved it.
I heard a couple of people who got hay in their shoe, and they didn't like that. wear a shoe cover. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. So by the time this goes up, which will be Monday morning, Gloucester will have already happened. So you are going to have to do a prediction for who you think, how it's going to turn out, the elite men and elite women, and then everybody else will be able to tune in Monday morning to see how you did.
All right. Well, first of all, do we know if Katie Compton has got a start spot yet?
I don't know where she is on the wait list. I have a feeling that she will be there.
But we can not get
in there. But we can do that. We can do with or without Katie Compton. You know, it was sort of funny because when that story first came out, the whole uproar, a lot of it was like, what possibly could the European cyclocross community think about us idiot Americans not letting this multinational champion into one of the biggest races? And then hours later, we find out that Klaas Van Tornout wasn't offered a contract for the B-Post Trophy series, and he's the Belgian national champion. You know, so like, everybody just take a step back.
Everybody calm down and let's just figure this out.
Yeah.
All right. So here we go. If Katie's there, I think she wins it. I think she's far enough removed. She was sick in Vegas.
Right.
A lot of people knew that. She'd been battling a head cold. I think she's far enough away from that, and I think she's going to be strong enough to win on that course and in that field. I think Vegas, it helped people like Catherine and Katarina that were there, and a lot of these other fast Euro women that were able to kind of work together and maybe pull away from her. I think Katie's back on her A game. She wins it if she's there. I think if Katie doesn't race, I love Crystal Anthony, and I think that on that course that's right down the street from her hometown in Beverly, Massachusetts, I think this could be the year that Crystal has a really good couple of days at Gloucester. I mean, she's had good days. She's won there before, but I think she's on really good form. I'd love to see Crystal do well. On the men's side, obviously Powers is going to take it. I mean, that's as much his hometown race as anything. I think he's racing 2 days this year. That's what I've heard from him.
He's
going to be racing a lot more Saturday and Sundays. But without him, I'd say Powers wins it. The guy I would love to see take a win there, or at least be close behind on the podium, is Stephen Hyde.
Yeah.
I'd love to see him be able to pay back Stu and Cannondale Cyclocross World with the opportunity that they gave him this year by really being able to deliver here and have some great results. So Steven on the podium, Powers on the podium, a couple other local guys might sneak in there. They tend to do that in the New England races, but yeah, nothing out on a limb there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Hyde and Powers are going to have some good battles this year. Hyde is, you know, he's just a guy that never gives up, and that they, you know, spend a lot of time together, training together. I think that's going to be fun to watch, those two going at each other. So on the women's side, though, is Nash going to race? You don't think this is something that Katarina can keep that form going?
That's a good – I haven't seen the start list. Is she definitely there?
I don't know. I haven't either.
Yeah. If she's there, it's a different story. But you got to look at history as well. I mean, Katarina, as far as I know, has beaten Katie Compton – I'm going to say maybe 3 or 4 times ever on U.S. soil. Fort Collins 2011, Providence 2013, a couple other times. But I mean, Katie just doesn't lose bike races.
Right.
It rarely happens. So again, if you're asking from like my dark horse, I could give you a bunch, but I'm putting money on it. There's no way I don't put my money on Katie. Even if Katarina does show up and she's in dominating form right now, I think we've all learned better than to ever bet against Compton.
All right. Talked about it briefly at the beginning about the segment you used to do, the Who's Number One segment. I'm going to do a little variation on that now. So it's just going to be like sort of like first impressions, first thing in your mind. I'm going to give you the rider. You tell me what you think. All right?
I'm going to bite my tongue on this one. Go for it.
All right. I'm going to start with the men. Jamie Driscoll.
The dangler. I wish he'd be more aggressive and spend more time at the front instead of watching other guys.
Ryan Trebon.
So glad to see him back. So many people kind of wrote him off last year with the injury and getting older now, but I think Vegas proved that Ryan is one of, if not the most talented cross racers we have.
Cameron Dodge.
Somebody give that kid a mother effing contract. I swear to God, forget Trebon. Cameron Dodge might be one of the most talented bike racers, period, in North America, and he does it on his own weekend after weekend on the podium. Somebody write that kid a check.
Yeah, you know, I talked to him a couple weeks ago, and it's sort of, he just does his own thing. That's the thing about him. So I think that's a two-way street with him. Like, I was talking about him going to Vegas, and, you know, he said, yeah, they asked me to go, but I've gone the last 2 years and it's a long way away. And, you know, I'll do other, this is what I loved about him. He was like, well, I'll do other UCI races like Charm City. So, so in his head, somehow a World Cup race and a C2 in Baltimore, a race I absolutely love, one of my favorite races that, you know, I'll be out there announcing, are the same level. So that's,
yeah, I mean, you got it. He's his own guy. You got to let him do his own thing, but he deserves the level of support.
Yeah, that's the thing.
That
absolutely.
These other guys are getting.
Yep.
So.
All right. Stephen Hyde.
Stephen Hyde. My favorite redhead other than my wife. Just excited for new opportunity for him. He had a lot of guidance with Jam Fund. He had a lot of support there, but the way that Stu Thorne and those guys do things, I think we may be witnessing our next dominant rider for the next 5-10 years.
I think you might be right. Dan Timmerman,
the caveman. I just love Dan. I think he's a great story. The way he came back, the way he's like this like mysterious man who lives off in the woods and no one really knows
right.
much about him. I love him. I think Richard Sachs is a perfect fit for him, but I'll hang out with Dan any day.
Yeah, I mean, he stands no tubes now. Moved on.
Yeah. Oh, right. Oh, sorry. Yeah. You're right. Well, he was a great fit with
yep. Oh, absolutely.
With Sachs, and yeah, that's true. Glad to see him now get the opportunity.
I think once he shaved, he had to find a new team.
Right.
Curtis White.
I just think about living in Logan Owen's shadow. Honestly, that's the first thing that comes to mind with him. Such one of the most talented young riders we've had in forever, and he's had the disadvantage or the advantage. Logan's pushed him for sure and helped him get to his level, but the disadvantage of every year having to grow up in that shadow, it's not tough being the second best guy on the Chicago Bulls or
right.
something.
Zach McDonald,
man, kind of like a Cameron Dodge story. Someone give that kid a contract. I mean, yes, it kind of like Cameron. He's a unique character. He's not for everybody. But the talent level is off the charts. He loves it. He wants to do it. But he's not going to live in a van down by the river to do it. So,
right.
Yeah, somebody's giving him a chance.
All right, just a couple more here for the men's side. Alan Krugoff,
Boulder's finest. I love Alan. I think Alan represents the working man pro at every level, from masters to elites. I mean, Alan's one of those guys. And this is where I'm going to get in trouble, but I've said this before, I don't think Alan Krugoff is genetically gifted enough to win a World Cup or to be on the podium. I think most people who looked at it reasonably would agree with that, but I think he's incredibly talented, and I think he's shown the exact model of how to make a sustainable career out of bike racing while still having a life. He started his own team. He's done all the right things, but he has a great work-life balance. He's a great photographer and these other things that he does. So, I think about working man's pro.
Nice. All right. Talk about getting in trouble.
Jonathan Page. Yeah. Talking about getting in trouble. I love Jonathan Page. I grew up racing underneath him for years in New England. He was out of New Hampshire. One of my first ever mountain bike races, I remember, you know, he was the guy. He won the overall. I had no idea who he was, but he immediately became, you know, an idol of mine as the fastest guy around. And what he went on to do was insane. Jonathan, I'm sure, probably he's not my biggest fan these days. There's been stories and rumors out there about that, which all false, by the way. And I'd love to sit down with Jonathan and talk about it sometime. But, no, Jonathan, his contribution to the sport of cyclocross is invaluable.
Logan Owen,
man, I wish that road racing were not a thing, because if we could get him full-time for cross, I think, you know, was it Cyclocross Magazine that did the whole Next Spend Nice thing? I don't think that's a reach or an exaggeration by any means. If we got 100% of his attention to the fall, it would be just deadly.
All right, last one, Jeremy Powers.
I mean, I could give you a whole hour on Jeremy Powers. Just the fan favorite. Again, what Jeremy's, for everything that Jeremy does as an athlete, it's what he's done as a person that has made him to the level he's at and has made him as respected and as admired as he is. It's the last few years for him to turn into an excellent bike racer, that's been a carry on top. So the fan favorite, just one of the most fun guys to hang around with.
All right, on to the women's side. Katarina Nash,
man, I wish she had her U.S. passport and chose to race for us. But other than that, just, one of kind of a Curtis White situation in terms of always having to play second fiddle to Katie Compton, it seems, but she's had plenty of her own. Four-time Olympian and World Cup winner, mountain bike and cyclocross. Katarina holds her own.
Yeah, there's a handful on this list who are going to be residents versus citizens. But next one, sure. Meredith Miller.
I wish we could have got her full-time cyclocross in like the full prime of her career. I feel like she came to cross a little bit later in her career and she had some outstanding years, but I would have loved if we had had a good 15 years of Meredith Miller instead of whatever we have now.
Absolutely. All right. Caroline Mani
is a French woman. Can't seem to get out of her own way. She can't stop crashing. I feel like every time I see Caroline, she's laying on the side of the course somewhere, grabbing her wrist or grabbing her knee. So I don't know if it's luck or what, but an insanely talented bike rider, unlucky bike handler.
Crystal Anthony,
New England sweetheart. I mean, the Anthony dynasty could be its own show. Coming up under Josh and Jesse and Papa Joe, I think she's been an incredibly fast bike racer for a long time, but a lot of people didn't really know who she was or what she was about. I think she's started to come out of her shell a lot. If you follow her on social media and things like that, she's just being a lot more open about her life and her career, and I think once people get to know Crystal Anthony as a person in addition to bike racing, I think she's going to develop a pretty big following.
Ellen Noble.
I love Ellen. When I think of Ellen, I think of equality in cyclocross for men and women, and the fact that Ellen should have four world championships under her belt by now and a handful of World Cups. And I think a lot of the attention that Ellen has helped bring to that issue is going to be the reason why the next Ellen Noble at 17 and 18 gets a chance to go to Europe and
right.
gets a chance to race at that higher level. But Ellen's a huge talent.
Absolutely. Ellie Anderson.
Heartbreaking right now. I mean, I wish we had her. I think a lot of people have read the Cyclocross Magazine article and you know, everything that she touches on about the troubles of last year. I feel like she's barely scratching the surface. I mean, I feel like if you really had a candid, open conversation with her about what life was like for her last year, it was heartbreaking. And so excited that she's going to get a chance to come back. And I don't think it's going to take her very long to get back to the top.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw it today. She sent out a press release announcing our SRAM Strava team. So hopefully that's a new beginning and she can get excited about being out there racing again. So
yeah, if her head can match her physical fitness, then she's going to be untouchable again.
Katie Antineau.
The little badger. Katie Antineau. Man, I don't know where to go with that one. I guess my first thought is, if you had asked me 5 years ago what I would say, I would have said Katie Anthony, the new Katie Compton, the most dominant woman in cyclocross. And I remember, I think it was 2011 at Louisville USGP, she out-sprinted Katarina Nash to take silver on the day, a couple seconds behind Katie Compton. And she's stayed at that very high level, but I think in a similar situation to Logan Owen, she's been racing road and focusing on that. I don't think we've seen the next level of Katie Anthony just quite yet.
All right, last one, Katie Compton.
KFC, 11-time cyclocross national champion, just the greatest ever. She is, I think she's the GOAT, the greatest of all time in U.S. cyclocross, men or women. I dare anyone to make a rational argument otherwise.
Absolutely. Not going to get it here. Awesome. All right. Anybody I'm missing?
I don't know, 100 people on either side. I know. We don't have to talk about them.
That's the thing. And it's like, those are just the established ones. You know, you look at the folks coming up, the Gage Hecks out there and Spencer Petrov, Lance Hayes. I mean, it's the fields, I think we got a lot to be excited about for U.S. cyclocross in years to come with what's going on in the junior and U23 fields.
Oh, for sure. I mean, this is the first Who's Number One I ever did. It was like 19 minutes long. I couldn't stop talking about these riders because it's like, this is what I love. It's what I care about. It's what I'm interested in. So, like even now you're asking me to give you one word and I have to narrow it down to a paragraph.
But, yeah, no, that was fine. So, that was perfect.
Yeah. There's so many people to talk about. There's so many unique stories out there. It's what makes this all exciting.
Awesome. Well, I only have one little last thing that's not really, cyclocross related to talk to you about, but do you have anything just with the sport that you want to cover?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll give you my one thing, and it just comes from the media perspective, and that would be live coverage. Everybody wants it. The racers want it. The events want it. The fans want it. The industry who sponsors the athletes in the events want it. The media companies want it. The cost has come down so much right now that the ability to do it at a really high quality for low cost is out there. It breaks my heart that there isn't someone dedicating their time and their resources to making that a reality. Every UCI cross race in North America should have a quality live broadcast. So that would be, if I could help with one, you know, personal to me issue, that would be it.
So let me ask you about this with doing the live broadcast, setting it up, technically speaking, setting up all the cameras, setting up the sight lines. Is this something, I think part of the problem, I mean, one, you don't have all the cameras, you don't have Sporza's budget, you don't have, you know, dollies out there and huge cranes and all that kind of stuff. But on top of that, if you look at the courses in Europe, they're all made for TV. They all have these great sight lines. They've all figured out the angles that they can shoot over the crowd, that they can get the most out of each camera and the most angles. Is that something that when you were doing these broadcasts, you would work with a promoter to say, look, if we can just get rid of that section out in the woods where no one's seeing them anymore, or, you know, bring this turn in here, it would make for a better broadcast. Is that a discussion that happened?
Every single race over. I mean, without fail, you'd show up, you'd set up on Friday, you'd get your lines all set up, you'd get your shots ready, and then you'd come the next morning and the promoter had put up thick black snow fencing across that whole section of the course, and now the camera couldn't see any of it.
Right.
It was especially in the early days going where, I mean, I did the first ever broadcast of a live broadcast of Las Vegas in 2009 with just me and one camera. But it's so, and I think something like 42,000 people watched it that night. It was me with a backpack that streamed live to a cell phone tower, and I had 40,000 people around the world watching. There was probably 8,000 people at the venue, and that's being generous. But it's so hard to make the promoter think about anything other than, are the porta potties in the right spot? Is the course set up? Is registration handled? I mean, and rightfully so. That's what's on their plate. That's what they have to deal with. Cross Vegas is a big example, but when you go to some of these smaller races where you have maybe 500 people spectating and 10 or 20 or 50,000 people online, it shouldn't be that hard to convince promoters to modify things a little bit to be more camera friendly. And I think once that becomes more of a regular event, like once I had done a number of these, like people like Joan Hanscom and the USGP, they would absolutely set up their course now. This is going to be great for TV. This is going to be a great section for your camera. So it doesn't take long for everybody to figure that stuff out.
Yeah. And I love looking, you know, I've watched, I will argue, more European cyclocross than most people out there, just the little things that you see, like they'll put tape on one side and then the banners on the other side. So you can see the racers exactly. And then you can still see the advertising. You know, they've just thought about all that. But one thing I wanted to bring up just, you know, from your early broadcast, was it Nationals in Portland?
Bend,
Oregon. That was amazing. One freaking camera standing on a muddy hill between two sections of the course. I think you saw the whole race and you were just like on it. I mean, that was one of the most amazing broadcasts to watch at, you know, what your costs and what your equipment was. Talk about guerrilla broadcasting. Just absolutely amazing.
And it was a piece of technology called a live pack. These were these backpacks with these, like, essentially they were massive cell phones. They would, you know, connect through all these cell towers and broadcast these fairly quality video streams. But these things were developed for, like, CNN to be on the ground in Afghanistan and, you know, broadcast live from wherever they went. And our company, Flowcast, got our hands on these things. They were $2,500 a month to rent one, which for us was great because we were using them with our track and field website, with our wrestling website. And we had yet to use one for cycling because I didn't think it would be worth it. We just had this one backpack and this one camera, but it was national championships. It's the biggest day ever. We had it in town. We had just done a track and field event, in Portland the weekend before. And so, yeah, I had a buddy wear the backpack and hook up the camera, and I held a little wireless mic, and you can go back and watch it. He followed me around all day, and I was the weirdo in the crowd screaming into this little plastic microphone. No one knew that we had, you know, 15,000 people on the other end of that camera that tuned in that day. And that was huge for cycling dirt and for what we were able to do from a live standpoint. I mean, that sparked a lot of phone calls after that of, hey, how did that work? And can you do more of that?
Yeah, no, it was amazing. It was revolutionary. I loved it.
You know, you're OG cyclocross fan when you remember that broadcast. That was early days.
That was great. So, As we're ending up here, you had something you wanted to talk about. What's up?
I do. I have a question for you. And having not had the opportunity to do Who's Number One for the last couple of years, or at least do it on film, I sit around and I do it every Sunday night on my own in my living room when I look at results. But this is a show that I always wanted to film, and I've always wanted to get a response from the average fan out there. So I think it's an interesting question. It's all about the hashtag CX Dream Team. If we have a four-lap relay, one elite man, one elite woman, one U23 man, and one junior man from any point in the history of U.S. cyclocross, I want to know your four riders, and I want to know your racing order. The racing order doesn't, I guess, have so much to do with it, but I want to know your four riders, one lap apiece. You want me to go first, or you want to go?
You go. I'll see how much overlap we have.
I'm going to kick things off with my U23 men. I think they're snappy. I think they're going to be good for a whole shot. There's some great guys to talk about there. Logan Owen obviously is going to come to mind. Zach McDonald was amazing. I would kick myself if I didn't at least mention Matt Kelly, world champion. But I think the fastest ever U23 man we've ever had was Tim Johnson. Two-time U23 national champion. And when Tim was a U23, he was by far closer to his highest level, I think, than anybody else was. So I'm going to lead off with Tim Johnson. Then I'm going to go to the women. I'm not going to go Katie Compton. I'll just get that right out of the way right now, and here's why. Katie Compton is an excellent cyclocross racer. She is not an excellent starter of cyclocross races. Her first lap is never all that hot. So as much of a warm-up as she does in a one-lap relay, I'm not taking Katie Compton. I might even take Nicole Duke over Katie Compton because she's a whole shot queen, but I am taking the six-time cyclocross national champion Allison Dunlop in her prime for my one lap. Then I'm going to my junior men. Again, you could go with maybe Logan Owen. Luke Keough would be a great choice, dominant junior racer in his time, but you can't not go with Jesse Anthony, seven-time junior and U23 cyclocross national champion. When he was a junior riding for Hot Tubes, Jesse Anthony was a man-child. He was an unbelievably strong junior rider, racing in UCI races, finishing top 10 on a regular basis. I'm going to go Jesse, and then I am going to close things off with and there's, again, so many names you could have gone with: Powers, Page, Mark McCormick for one fast lap. But I'm going to go with raw horsepower here. And nobody puts out more power for 5 minutes on a bicycle anywhere on a cyclocross course than Ryan Trebon. So I'm going to anchor things with Trebon.
Nice.
So I am going Tim Johnson, Allison Dunlap, Jessamy Anthony, Ryan Trebon.
Man, that's tough to beat. All right. So for my junior for one lap, you went with him for a U23. I'm going with the world's podium, Tim Johnson. He's my junior. He's going to give me that one lap. For my U23, after seeing what he did on the first lap at the 2000 and... it was one of the Wisconsin years. I think it was the first Wisconsin year when he actually...
2011.
2011, raced the U23 race and then came back and nobody sort of stopped him. He raced the elite race too. Zach McDonald off the line and through that first lap. He's my U23. Yep. For that performance alone. For my elite male, just knowing how the guy starts... He can't be left out of this. I went through the list. Trebon definitely was on my list. Jonathan Page, when he was, on the podium at Worlds, definitely would have been there. But again, if we're going with starts, the little gear, the tiny little gear and the 200 RPM cadence or whatever he gets up to, but I gotta have Powers out there. I gotta have Powers in his little ring just crushing it. Going out.
Yep.
And then for the women, as you said before, you can't bet against Katie Compton. And I understand that she has these poor starts and that, she has a problem clipping in and everything. But let's give it a 6-7 minute lap. I still think by the end of that first lap, knowing that she only has to do one, she's right up there at the front leading the way by the time it finishes off. So
yeah, give me Allison Dunlap, fall of 2001, fresh off mountain bike world title. I would have loved to see those two race in their prime.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is fun. So we can have everyone else chime in and tell us where we're wrong and give your own CX Dream Team, hashtag CX Dream Team, and let us know.
Bunch of a Twitter responder, I will respond to people's tweets on this.
All right. So Colt,
I will fight for.
Colt on Twitter is at DoperSuck. And
yes,
I am at CX Hair. So that's going to be awesome. Let's definitely hear what you all have to say about your hashtag CX Dream Team. All right, Colt, finish things off here. We're going to move a little bit away from cycling. And I'm going to get some free training advice from you. All right?
Go for it.
Okay. I need you to create a training plan that allows me to be able to two-hand dunk a regulation ball on a regulation rim within 2 months from now.
Right now,
I can tell you.
Or no?
What's that?
No time machine involved?
Nope. I am 46 years old. Okay. Right now, I can maybe touch the rim.
All right. Two-hand?
I'm
standing still or?
No. Can be running start. We could do one hand. We could do one hand. Two hand is just so much more satisfying, though.
I know. All right. Here's what you need. For right. one, you need to stop riding. You need to stop riding your bike. You need to convert.
Already did that.
10 to 15, convert that 10 to 15 percent of changeable gray muscle fibers back over to fast twitch that you spent the last 20 years turning into slow twitch aerobic. Bad burning muscle fibers. You got to get your bounce back foremost. Okay. You got to hit the diet hard. You got to bring. It's all watts per kilo in dunking. It's the same idea. You got to lose a couple of those extra pounds, and then you got to hit the weight room. Squats, leg press, and most important, box jumps. You got to do every single legged driver box jump over and over again. And then once you're done with that, you got to go start playing basketball again because you can have a 30-inch vertical. But if you don't have the coordination to take off the right foot and reach that rim at just the right time, it doesn't matter.
All right. I may need more than 2 months.
Maybe.
and that time machine. So where did that start with you? Where did the basketball come into play with all of this?
Before I was a full-time eat, sleep, and bleed bike racing, I was eat, sleep, and bleed basketball. My brother played growing up. He was into it. We had a hoop in the driveway. I mean, I was, you know, 2-3 years old out playing on my mini hoop. And as a kid, all I wanted to do was go play for Coach K at Duke and be a starting power forward for the Chicago Bulls. So I went to, I mean, I played AAU and I played travel and I went to all the camps all summer, and that was my life. I was trying to go D1 and do the whole thing, and bike racing came into the fold and had to pick one or the other. And I don't regret it, but I certainly wish I could have split and had two lives, because I would have loved to follow that up.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear you there. Did you go to a 5-star camp?
I went to everything, man. Yeah. I was at those. I did. I would go to like Dave Cowan's camp and the Kevin McHale camp and just everything. And then last year, 2 years ago or something. I have an awful sneaker addiction, and so I buy a lot of shoes, and I never bought basketball shoes because it made me feel bad about never playing. And there was this one pair of shoes I really wanted, and I made a deal with myself. I was like, if I get these shoes, I'm also going to go down to the other aisle. I'm going to buy a basketball, and I'm going to go out and actually play in these things. And as you can imagine, it's like you play one day, you get all that buzz back, but you also suck. And so you're like, oh man, I got to go out again and prove myself that I'm better than that. And that turned into everyday basketball for 4 months.
Nice.
Turned into working out with another camp. Turned into, you know, by last year, the week. 2 weeks after I got back from Cross Vegas, I was supposed to try out with the Maine Red Claws, which is the NBA D-League affiliate to the Boston Celtics, and got home and tore my rotator cuff in practice and put a 3-month hold on things, and then I took this job out in California. So that's my what could have been story.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, once I had like knee surgery number one, and then I couldn't move laterally anymore, and that was it for me. But so my favorite memory from that time just doing all the camps was while he was still at Georgia Tech, John Sally was my coach at 5-star camp.
Awesome.
and you'll know, so this was like the the New York one, so the Honesdale, Pennsylvania one. He picked he picked an all white team.
Awesome. I love John.
That whole week was a trip. That was a good memory.
And there's nothing more fun than running into a guy at a bike race who knows and wants to talk basketball. It's like, I'll just get lost for hours, because I never get to, I spend all day talking about Al Anderson and Jimmy Driscoll. So if someone wants to talk about whether or not Big Shot Rob is one of the top five role players of all time, I could go for like 5 hours on that stuff.
Amazing. Well, maybe we'll have to do that another time. But for now, Colt, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today here on Crosshairs Radio. Awesome hour, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
And thank you, man. And I'm so psyched to see what you're doing and up in the level of everything that you're putting out with Crosshairs. And I mean, I'm a fan already, and I hope that people can find what you're doing and devour it, and ultimately lead to more excitement around this sport.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much.
So there you have it. That was Colt McElwain, and man, that was a fun conversation. Thanks a ton for joining us. We will be back here next week for episode 5 of Crosshairs Radio. Once again, you can follow us at CXHairs on Twitter, on Facebook at In the Crosshairs, CXHairs.com. Also, if you have any questions, comments, rants, raves, whatever it may be, send them to feedback@cxhairs.com, and we will see you next time.